Hello, I'm Sagar Baroshi.
And I'm John Ingold.
Welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Each week, we flip to a page of the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book, and we interview one of the contributors about their chosen topic. It's all about the craft of game writing. And this week, we have Stark Holborn. Welcome, Stark. Hello.
Hi, both. Thanks for having me on.
You are a delight to have, as you are one of our few guests that we have both, for sure, we're pretty sure, have met in person. So you are, for sure, a real human being. We can confirm it with our own eyes, we think.
Tell us a bit about yourself. I waved at you as we walked past each other, all of those things.
Yes, exactly. Tell us a bit about yourself, Stark, about what brings you to this career, to the present day.
Okay, yeah. Hi, everyone who doesn't know me. I'm Stark Holborn. I'm a novelist and a games writer. I got started with novels, my debut novel, Nunslinger, which was actually 12 novellas published as they were being written. And then stuck together into one big book. So it was Hodder's first ever digital serial. So even though I wasn't involved in games writing then, there was still an element of interactivity, readers wanting to know what was going to happen in the next instalment. From there, I ended up working on a lot of smaller games for Adult Swim and Cartoon Network and CBBC. From that, I eventually ended up as a lead writer on a game called Shadows of Doubt, which is an immersive, procedurally generated detective game set in a sort of neo-noir alternate 1980s city. And after that, I was working on a game called Novalis. I'm currently lead narrative writer on a game called Hopetown, which is coming out from a studio called Longview. And my writing is, you know, I write novels as well. So if you like things that sound a bit like Mad Max Fury Road in space, then check out my novel series. I think that covers most things.
Amazing. I think it's worth stressing that your novels have some of the best pun titles I have ever seen. Like the Trigonometry series is one of those things you go, oh, why has no one done that before? That's astonishing.
Well, no one's done it before because... you know, Westerns are quite niche, and maths Westerns are even more niche. Mm, and I would go so far as saying that mine is the only maths Western in existence. So,
what is the market missing out on, huh? That's what I have to say. What is wrong with readers these days?
It's just so satisfying when you see it written down. Anyway, I'm getting distracted. So on the podcast, we like to say, can you just sort of outline the article in the book? Some people haven't necessarily read it. So your article was called Soda Cans and Swiss Cheese. So that's going to need some explanation. So can you fill us in?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was searching around for a title for it, and I kind of landed on that because anyone who's played Shadows of Doubt will know that Starch Cola is a kind of a big presence in the world. It's both the kind of corporation president of the United Atlantic States in our version, but also the world is literally littered with these Starch Cola cans everywhere, and they contribute such a lot to the immersive world building that they're actually an incredibly important part of the game. So that's the soda can element to it. The Swiss cheese element refers to the method of procedurally generated systems we used, which combined authored content with proc gen to come up with this world where you have this sort of endlessly varied set of cases to solve.
So I think one of the things I was really interested in, because I've done a little bit of dabbling with procedural generation in my own work, is with every procedurally generated game, I feel like there's a balance between how much are you procedurally generating and how much are you procedurally distributing the content, if you see the distinction between those two things, because it's kind of a slippery thing and it's quite hard to talk about and describe, really. But like, some games will write 100 individual case files and then just deal one as though from a deck of cards, and then some games will develop the entire history of a dwarven civilization. I'm thinking the one game that does that. and then kind of build it there. So where on that kind of spectrum of kind of distribution to generation did Shadows of Doubt kind of end up sitting?
It's a really interesting one, and it actually probably has more in common with Dwarf Fortress in some ways, because with Shadows, everything that's being generated is all incredibly granular. And that's the thing. So a lot of people compared it to, you know, the one specs one city block concept, where it's, you know, you can explore every single facet of every building and every apartment and every drawer in that city block. And we're kind of doing the same thing with shadows. So there's a lot of information. A lot of it is procedurally generated, but it's kind of dispersed, because it's up to the player to encounter this stuff, right? It's up to the player to kind of explore the world and find little bits and pieces of it as they go along, you know, to search through trash and find a receipt, or to look at the back of the book and get a bit of the history of the world. So we're sort of doing both, but we're kind of writing all these little bits of pieces and then throwing it into like a dispersal machine. And then that's what the game then sort of disperses it through the city, and then you have to go and find it all.
Stark, you make a point that in the article that there are certain things you control in a procgen game and certain things you don't control. And the static content, these individual receipts, the sort of things you do, that can be put into a big spreadsheet, and you can just make a big list of them theoretically, right? Or, and you know, what they are, what the sort of text is upon them, or what the key hint is. But even if you are really intimately linked to whoever is designing that dispersal machine, I suppose, how do you communicate relevance, or do you at all, I suppose, in a game like this? Like, surely you, certainly in this genre, you need red herrings. You need more content than can be tugged on successfully. So how do you communicate to the player? How did you communicate to the player which things matter, which things don't?
It's a really interesting one. We actually made robust use of variables in this, and word replacements. So a lot of the text I would design, which is where the Swiss cheese comes in. I would sort of write the text, but it'll be full of holes, like a piece of Swiss cheese,
right,
where all the relevant information is going to get plugged in. And then it was up to me. I remember doing this one day, sitting outside. It was a nice day, and I had my spreadsheet, and I literally modularized murder. I was like, how do we make this modular? Okay, I'm going to like break down the killer types, the killer weapons. And I broke it down even as far as murder method dot adverb, I think. So, you know, brutally, tragically, all of this kind of stuff. So that we would have those fields that could then be used in the relevant place, if that's a newspaper article, if it's a receipt, if it's a diary. But in terms of the red herrings, what's interesting is players will sort of do that for themselves, because we're not putting any guardrails on what you can pick up, what you can open. And so the most interesting thing I always thought about watching new players play a game is it opens in an apartment, and, you know, it's littered with the type of things you'd find in any apartment, you know, pencil sharpeners and batteries and, you know, some like synth chicken in the fridge, and people would be...
That's right, picking, it is the 1980s, we have to remember, pencil sharpeners are everywhere.
everywhere. And so people would be picking up all of these random objects and be like, oh, this must be relevant, oh, they had chicken last night for dinner, this must be... And it's no, it's just a world, it's just a normal world, and it's up to you to actually sleuth through it and find what's relevant. And so it was interesting watching people kind of immediately assume, because something was present and had an item description, it was relevant, which is not what we were doing at all. And it's part of the fun of it, I think.
They were trained from other games, right? Like, yeah, what
exactly.
Things matter.
I love how that's kind of breaking the assumption from adventure games, where you kind of think, well, I'm going to reverse engineer how to solve a given puzzle because I know there's a pencil sharpener here, so I must
use to be
it
used
at some point. So,
yeah.
I mean, does that come with a... How did you deal with does that come with a cost of overwhelming the player? And I'm sort of assuming that it probably does. And if so, how do you deal with that? Like, how did you kind of work with that?
One of the hardest things, I mean, one of the hardest things with any game, but particularly this game, was the tutorial. And like, because it is a steep learning curve. It's kind of, you do throw a lot at the player and try to teach them all of these systems. So the tutorial is actually the only scripted event that happens in the whole game.
I was actually, that was one of my questions, was did you script the tutorial? Because almost every prop game does, I think, because...
It is still prop gen, but there are scripted elements to it, because we had to, because it was just impossible. And we had to do some quite mad things to get it to work. So the game actually has to simulate the past to make sure the tutorial works properly. because you have to be able to go through CCTV, and the person you're following has to appear. So the game has to simulate 3 days in the past before it can even begin. So we did tie ourselves into kind of knots over that, but it works in the end. But it was tricky, really tricky to get right. And I think a lot of it was, you know, it's you always get this argument with tutorial systems, and I kind of used to be of the mindset that you try and make, when you're tutorializing something, as immersive as possible. But in this case, we just had to tell the player what to do. And I do think there's nothing wrong with a bit of tell sometimes. If it's going to give player information, let them get going, then that's what we needed to do.
Well, I mean, it's often a sign that you're working in a genre that doesn't exist or like is fairly new. And like, yeah, the immersive procedural generated detective story. It's kind of funny because it's a concept I've seen before. I remember in the 1980s, there was a kind of Cluedo top-down thing called Sleuth, where you went from room to room, like talking to murderers, and it used a very, very simple templating system. So that idea of let's re-roll the murder each time, but at the same time, as a comparison to Shadows of Doubt, it's a bit like comparing the wheel to a spaceship. It's like, yeah, they both get you somewhere, but like I'm not sure they're really very comparable things. I think one of the things I'm also interested with procedural generation is like there's something very joyous and raucous about it, because it's quite transgressive in a way to say, not only am I gonna, you know, release some of my authorial control over what's happening, I'm gonna actively sort of not have that control. Like, is that fun as a writer? Is that frustrating? Were there times when you were just like, I just want to make this one bit more specific? Or kind of, did you just embrace the chaos? Or how was that as an experience?
With a game like this, you have to embrace the chaos. Like, there are always going to be edge cases. It's always probably going to, like, break in certain... But I think that means it's ambitious and it's trying to do something kind of big and different and unusual. And yeah, you get, like, with any kind of improc gen, you get these amazing emergence of, like... emergent storytelling that happen completely without you kind of realizing they're going to happen. So one of my favorite examples was, you know, you can sneak into people's rooms or apartments and hide in their cupboards and watch them and stuff, which sounds, you know, you can play it like a complete stalker if you want to, but I was hiding in these people's cupboard waiting for them to go to bed so I could sneak around their apartment and find some evidence,
as you do,
but they were a couple, and one of them would get out of bed and turn the light on and then get back into bed, and the other one would get back and turn it off again. And they did this for literally like the in-game equivalent of an hour of like this passive aggressive turn the light off, turn the light on, turn the light. And in between they would have these...
You couldn't write that. It's too good. Yeah.
It was fantastic. And in between they would then have these like random small conversations that I'd written to take place between, like, you know, a couple. So one of them would be like, you never pick up any milk. And then they get back up and turn the light on and off again. And it was, you know, I didn't design it that way, but it was fantastic. And it was just the system doing what we'd asked it to do, but we had no idea it would come up with something quite like that. But it was using everything we'd written and everything we'd designed. So, yeah, there are many moments of kind of absolutely chaotic kind of storytelling. And I think that's... One where Shadows works best is where people role play. It's where people really kind of play the detective. And I think I said this in a talk before. When you read the Steam reviews, a lot of them are written first person. They're saying, you know, oh, then I broke into an apartment and I fell down the elevator shaft and I threw a can at a policeman and he chased me. And they're these kind of storytelling, people relating, recounting kind of almost a personal experience. And I think that tells me we've done our job.
With procedural generation, when you first start trying it, because it's something that people sort of naturally try, they quite often will, you know, you'll make a story and you swap in a few variables and you feel like you're doing an awful lot of work, and then you play it and you get back something which is, oh yeah, it's that one. It's a type A with this noun and that noun. And I don't think I've ever personally been past the complexity threshold at which there are enough systems that it starts to genuinely kind of become more than the sum of the work that went into it. Like, do you think Did you manage to get to that point, do you think? Or does it always feel to you, because obviously you can see the components at work, do you still see the wiring the whole time, or does it come alive?
I mean, for me, it kind of always has come alive. And I think it's a difficult one. I think we haven't been in... I think it's a very successful game. I don't think it's entirely successful at doing, you know, a perfect version of, you know, an immersive proc gen murder. But I think... For how it was made in the time it was made by the amount of people it was made by, which was their only... I mean, Cole was the sole developer for a lot of this, and there were only three of us at various points. Other people came on later, but we were a tiny team, really. I think a lot of people assume it was made by a much bigger studio. But...
Extraordinary.
Yeah, that's... It's almost 10 years of work have went into it from when Cole started to now. But I think one of the things it is that it does do successfully is it presents such a big possibility space for people to explore in such a big sort of sandbox that I think the fun often comes... Some people will come up against the edges quite quickly and they'll be like, oh, I know it's that archetype and it's this one and I have to find this. But I don't think they're maybe the people who particularly enjoy playing it anyway. I think... The people who really enjoy playing it, again, sort of role play and think, oh, right, I'm going to do a playthrough where I don't hit anyone, or I'm going to do a playthrough where I'm just completely drunk the whole time. So they take the systems that we present and then decide how to interact with them and decide how to interact with the world. If we'd had loads more time and money, then maybe we could have had a more complex kind of personality and dialogue system, because at the moment... a lot of the people you speak to, the NPCs, they won't necessarily remember you after a certain point. And honestly, we were just at memory limit after a certain point, because the game is simulating so much of the time. Yeah, that we hit the wall.
It makes me wonder, Stark, because it's such a unique project and one that you clearly sunk your teeth into kind of right away, you were already... a professional writer, an experienced writer, before arriving at a project like this. Just zooming out a bit, how does this work for you at this phase of your career? Were you sort of looking? This doesn't seem like the type of role that it was just like openly advertised that you just sort of found exactly. And even if it were, did Cole already have in his head the vision that this is the way that it was to be written? I mean, you were such a small team. Like, help me understand how you even arrived at this final product, because the shape of it is so singular that I find it hard to imagine that it was all clear at the beginning.
I know. I mean, it changed a lot. I mean, when Cole started working on it, it was actually top down. It was a police station management game, which then became... Okay. And then you read some of the early dev blogs and it's hilarious. There's one where he says, oh, I've put a first person element in. It's going to be purely time waster because, you know, I mean, it's a rabbit hole. And if it went down that, God, can you imagine what that would be like? It's like you look at the date and it's like 2016 or something. Oh, God. So it became first person. And I think at that point, I'd met Cole through Nick, aka Mono Moon, who was doing all of the sound and music. And then Nick sort of introduced me to Cole, and I said, well, would you like any eyes? It sounds like a really exciting project. Would you like someone to cast some eyes over the writing?
And so at this point, you hadn't yet worked in GameStar? Or
I had, but on smaller projects. Right. This was like, that I'd done lots of dialogue and kind of lots of game design, narrative design, but for smaller things. My first ever games job was actually for the BBC. And it is writing an interactive, multiplayer interactive fiction game for their R&D department. And I had no idea how complicated that would be, but I had to do it. So it was before, maybe Inkle was around, but it was before I was aware of any of the things like, you know, ink or Artisy. So it was all done with individual files and... Yes, we made it work, and luckily we didn't have to go to market with it because it was just an R&D project. But anyway, I'd done stuff like that before, so I had some idea of what I was doing. And then really it became from there, once I got involved, it was fleshing out the world, doing all the world building, and and then working with Cole to design these modular systems, which we'd use. And then Cole actually made a bespoke dialogue editor once we kind of realized what we'd need. And that's what we used for as a tool for the rest of the development.
Stark, listening to you talk about that and your BBC project, I get this very strong impression that you're someone who is not necessarily, not like in a kind of, you're not necessarily a technical person, but you're clearly not afraid of technical stuff at all. Because like you meet some writers who say, I can't imagine how you work on interactive content. I remember you meet people who talk to you like you're an alien when you work in interactive fiction. They're sort of like, oh, it's impossible. That clearly does not apply to you at all. So do you enjoy the technical constraints, the technical challenges, or is it that you just don't care and you just charge straight through it?
Probably
do you relish it? Or
It's probably a bit of both, to be honest. I mean, I like being a beginner at stuff sometimes. So, So I like learning new things, and I don't necessarily find it terrifying. There's always a moment when you're learning a new tool. It's like, you know, when I first started using Artsy the first time, I was like, oh God, this is so big and I don't know how to do it. But I think it's because I learn best through doing anyway. So I'll learn something by just trying, picking it up and mucking around with it and then trying to do something with it, which is probably quite helpful when it comes to...
So it sounds like a sort of energetic naivety or something. It's like,
oh,
whatever,
yeah,
I do,
absolutely.
Right? Just keep going. And then do you find that when you find the boundaries of a tool, is that something that you... Like, are you happy to sit within the boundaries of a tool, or do you try to push the boundaries the whole time? Like, oh, this system doesn't really do this and this, so I'm going to make it do it. Like, because you meet people who kind of sit either way on that. Like, do you prefer to kind of work, discover what the tool can do and then use it effectively, or do you like to kind of break it, special case it, abuse it, get what you can out of it?
No, I think there's people who are probably a lot cleverer than me at using tools to their fullest advantage. So, you know, I don't mind not kind of pushing something right to its limits. Although the thing I do that with is fiction. I'm much more comfortable in trying to force linear fiction to do non-linear things. So I wrote a short story recently for an anthology that you have to read by flipping a coin. Because I wanted to do an interactive fiction short story, but it had to be linear. It had to be printed and linear. And I was like, right, how can I force it? How can I force it to be interactive? So I'm much more comfortable doing it in, I suppose because I was a novelist first. That's the medium probably feel comfortable with. And I can use tools. I can get familiar with them, quite happy with them. We pushed Artsy some pretty like big extremes, but I think that's more from the programming side, and that's more from trying to get it to talk the same language and kind of Unity stuff. But
Well, speaking of your novelist career, I find that you seem to be someone who understands genre really, really well, given how you mash them up, how you sort of choose where to set something, what characters that you can tug on, and what tropes you can use and subvert. Is this something that you think of consciously, the Western genre specifically pulls to you as it does in so many of your novels? Even this game is also, you're using certain ideas theoretically to help the player kind of immerse themselves in. How do you think about genre in your work, if at all?
So I do write cross-genre quite a lot. The Western one is interesting. I've kind of inadvertently become a bit of an expert in them. I didn't even like them growing up. And I think if you'd said to me, I think if you said when I was, you know, a kid, they were like, oh, you're going to be writing Westerns. I'd be like, what are you talking about? Like, but I think I just became fascinated by them because they're such a slippery, weird, problematic genre. And I kind of wanted to, like, pick it up and shake it and make it do different things, because I hated all of the John Wayne Westerns and I found them such sort of macho bullshit. So I was like, right, maybe I can do something different with this. I think when one of the things I love doing with world building and with novels and with games writing is really immersing in a world and in a genre. And I think I especially with writing and getting the right tone. So often with Shadows of Doubt, I'd spend ages on YouTube, like listening to old 1950s adverts or like 1980s news programs, just trying to capture that kind of hyper-capitalist tone.
The texture of it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of what I love doing in my fiction as well. You know, I a lot of people say, especially my science fiction books, are very immersive and they can kind of feel all the grit and the sand and the like the lack of oxygen. And that's one of the things I love doing. I think because I picture things in quite a visual way. I want to sort of bring people along for the ride as well.
So would it be fair to say that your writing projects, especially the ones that you've kind of designed yourself, so I guess that's the novels really, kind of from the ground up, are you more driven by the sort of the setting and the style, or are you kind of driven by the characters? What's your kind of way into a story? Like, or does it vary project to project?
No, it's often, I mean, setting's important, but it's really characters. And I always say, like, for me, plot comes from character. Like, I have to know who they are, and I have to know what they're doing or what they want. And then often the plot will just unfold. It will happen. And the times when I'm stuck with my novels, often it's because I've decided something has to happen and I'm trying to, like, cattle prod the character towards it, and it's not something they would ever have done. So then I'm like, right, okay, I need to go back and, like, rethink that. But setting is important. And, you know, with Nunslinger, I loved writing it, but, you know, not many people read Westerns. So I was like, well, how can I trick people into reading another one? So I'll set it on a desert moon. There we go. It's sci-fi.
Well, I have to say, space Westerns are my favorite little hidden subgenre that we've been developing lately. Partially because you can do so many different things that the older school, more traditional Westerns couldn't do. I mean, I love... You know, like, I love me a lonesome dove. That's great, right? Like, you can do these big maximalist stories, but like the sort of sharpness and often like the sort of melancholy that you get from from this subgenre that also doesn't seem so force linked to America specifically has also been really illuminating a little bit. There's just this great renaissance of RPGs these days, of tabletop RPGs. And there's an amazing one called Orbital Blues that is really trying to pull off of this.
Yes, I've seen this, yeah.
I'm blown away by it. I mean, it's amazing art design. It's an amazing style. And it really captures the sort of, this sort of sad Cowboy Bebop vibe that I feel like I've been like looking out for. Or the more optimistic version is maybe like the sort of Trigun example or something. But yeah, no, I want, just because you do so many of your Westerns in space, yeah, I wonder if those things have come across. Or just in general, how you deal with references, I'm curious about. Like, do you, because once you have a project going, you're going to be looking and grabbing for whatever you can. And I think that's probably a relatively common writerly experience. But does that ever come first? Because, like, now that it's not your first novel, you're not your first project. Do you ever get to a point where you're like, I'm so immersed now in this space that a new character seems evident to me that I've been saving in the back of my mind that I'd like to center a novel about, or that I'd like to center a story about? How do you go from sort of reference and immersion to that genre, to that world, into deciding what the next project is?
It was interesting with the first three, first of all, there was Tenno, which is the first sort of space Western book, and that was a very set thing. It was, you know, it was first person, present tense, story just sets off and goes. Kind of very small cast, quite propulsive. And then the second one, I decided to have two POVs, like one past, one present. So I then start pulling out the world in these slightly different directions. And kind of delving into the background of the setting as well. And then by the time I get to the third book, it actually centres on one of the characters who's 13 in the first novel. And then in this last book, it takes it all the way through until she's in her sort of late 40s. And it's called Ninth Life because it relates the 9 times she almost died across her years. And she's never actually a POV character. You only get her speech as reported speech. And the whole book is told through manuscripts and interviews,
really?
and things people have heard on the radio and snippets of conversation and dossiers.
Diegetic dialogue, yeah.
Yeah, so and I do wonder a bit about, I've spent so much time writing this stuff for Shadows of Doubt that kind of bled into that.
It does sound like environmental storytelling in the linear novel format. So, yeah, I'm getting the sense that you... are quite restless when it comes to structure and format and style. Like, presumably there are other things you haven't done yet that you want to do, or if a new idea comes along, is it just shiny and you're just like, oh, I'm going to jump on that now?
No, I've done well. There is something I would like to. I mean, I'd love to write that, like, another science fiction book, basically as a choose your own adventure. I'd like to push this whole my space western like another bit further. And I think some of the characters, there are these beings in the book called the Ifs, and they're, nobody knows if they exist or not. There's some people say they're aliens, some people say they're sort of demons. Some people say they don't exist, they're just a lack of oxygen and everyone's paranoid. But they're basically beings that feed on chance and doubt. So, you know, those moments where the world could split in two different directions, they inhabit that moment and try and cause chaos so they can cause the maximum amount of potential energy that they can feed on.
Oh, cool.
So they're almost like a mechanic themselves. Mm. They're almost like a dice roll or a coin flip. So I kind of wanted to see if I could make that work in fiction. I haven't tried yet, except for my coin flip story. But so let's see.
If you were to write a story in that mode, would you imagine it as being a story where you expect the reader to read every branch and then sort of trade them off against each other? Or would you see it as a story where the player is finding their true path through these narrative possibilities? Which one of those two appeals to you as a writer?
I think it depends on the reader. You kind of,
okay.
I think I would write it as like a quite propulsive, straightforward thing that you're following one path, knowing that people are probably going to go back and like, I don't know. There's something about if you can make people turn back through the book, it's quite transgressive. It's like you're making them break the format of like what they've normally been doing.
I would have thought it'd be great for publishers as well, because anything that makes people read your book multiple times means that they don't give it to a secondhand bookshop, right? So like this is a good thing.
They only buy it once though.
Yeah, that's true. You can't charge a subscription service for a print book. No one's figured that one out yet.
New business idea, exactly.
Yeah, it's not a good idea though.
No.
But your if characters could be the sort of moment of choice, obviously, right? Like so you could sort of keep moving, especially like given the novella format you did for Nunslinger. I know that this is now some ways in your past, but you could structure a sort of branching linear game in this way. I mean, in the full more cinematic branching types of titles I've worked on, As Dusk Falls is a game that I did for sort of Interior Night. You could play that whole game just through a dialogue tree, like just through through a long dialogue sequence, or a long text adventure, really. And depending on how important the text is to a given title, that could be entirely engaging just on its own right, right? So, yeah, you could use that type of format where you have a series of different climaxes that kind of bring things together and then explode back out, and your ifs could be like that little mechanical moment in the middle. That, I assume that's the type of thing you were thinking.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, tempting for it to get really big. I have actually written some interactive fiction using ink, which is set in the world of Factus, which is my world, and using those moments of choice and doubt. And I did have the idea to do a whole series, and then just ran out of time at the time. So, but I might go back to it. But yeah, it was good fun.
Ah, it's really interesting. I love this kind of use of branching. Like, because we quite often get obsessed about branching as being the mechanic. Like, if you have a text adventure, then like a twine-based piece or an interactive fiction piece, then the only thing the player can do is make choices. So you have to constantly give them choices, because otherwise they've got nothing to do. But it does mean you get stuck on these choices that can be very little or can be very fussy, or you just end up picking up crowbars to open doors the whole time and not really thinking in kind of grander narrative terms. And the good old days of Choose Your Own Adventures, you could just do whatever you liked and go anywhere with a plot, but no one really does that anymore. And I would love there to be a proper renaissance of that stuff. Like, I really feel like I'm missing it. But I don't know how to read it, I find is the problem. When I'm interacting with a text adventure, I know I click the choices to do the thing, and I understand that. But like reading a choose your own adventure, I get to the choice point and I say, well, I don't know which one is the right one. And I can't, I always get stuck on that. You need some way to make people have some attachment to the story despite not being in control of the story or something like that. But
well, it's almost like what you've done with the Kaleidoscope book, which is, you know, at the end, one thing I really love about it is at the end of each essay, you've got the different links, or different links, but different kind of arrows pointing you to something else. And the way I read that book is I don't read it linearly. I read it, you know, I'll go, oh, what's that one? And then I'll flip through a few forward and a few back, and then I'll look at these. So you're almost doing it with that anyway, that kind of structure. You have to let go and be like, I'm not going to read this cover to cover. I'm going to flow through it.
That was really interesting, because I did that mostly as a joke. I think someone mentioned it on the Discord channel for the writers, and I thought, yeah, sure, why not? That'll be funny. And then it was a horrendous amount of work, and word kept crashing. It was a disaster.
Sounds like interactive fiction to me.
Yes, exactly. That's how they all say. This will be funny.
I finalised it, and then somebody said, oh, am I too late to submit my article? And I was like, yes, you are, fine, I'll get it in. But what was interesting was when we sent it out, the proofs out to people, people really enjoyed it, and that quite took me quite surprised, because I assumed that people would just ignore it, look up their friends, and, you know, but I think there was kind of some draw in that, which is interesting. Yeah, it is interesting.
I think that this question is curious. This question of, like, why Choose Your Own Adventures felt like an 80s and 90s thing and didn't necessarily survive as a sort of product style later, and to some degree they have, right? They just kind of moved into video games a little bit, but we are seeing a pretty interesting renaissance of, like, printed material in that format, in the form of solo RPGs. So there are a huge number now of these, like, solo RPGs that you can find that are often sometimes journaling RPGs. So they're almost sometimes like writerly prompt stories that are interesting. And Chaosium, the sort of Call of Cthulhu company, they release a bunch of these alone in the fill in the blank, and pretty much all of them are, yeah, they're just Choose Your Own Adventures, and they, I think they do a pretty good job of dealing with this problem that you've raised, John, which is the problem is what do I do with this book? Am I going to an interesting outcome, or am I just going to discover, as I often did in the 80s books, oh, I've picked an outcome that's thrown me off a cliff and that's not terribly satisfying, and so now where do I go back to kind of, you're trying to just piece together the story as opposed to living in the story, as opposed to sort of experiencing what role-playing it the way your character might. But by going through this other format, they're just a bit gentler with it. They're just a bit more careful about kind of where these decisions are. And to bring us back to Shadows of Doubt, that format requires the type of work that you said, John, like the sort of, like, you're sort of thinking through every single thing. You have to visualize the entire network and kind of ensure that all the connections work in a way that is satisfying, or that's your goal often. But it doesn't sound like that's the way you wrote in Shadows of Doubt, Stark, right? It doesn't sound like you sort of said, here are the 50 different potential murder paths I want to happen. Instead, it seemed like you wrote, like, ingredient lists throughout, or role tables, you might say, and then you thought of ways that they made sure that they could all be combinable. Is that correct, or did you, like, how did you manage to structure an entire actual successful murder? Because we've talked around that problem, but I'm curious, yeah, how do you ultimately contend with it so that the player's experience is satisfying, beginning to end of a story?
It's really interesting, and I mean, it was all modular, so that helped once we were able to break it down into a modular format, in a way that we could then break those modules down into variables and word replacements. But then we also mapped out the killer's journey, like, as a flowchart, right. Okay. You know, what they would do, when, where they would go, who they interact with, what the evidence points are, because you can solve a murder by knowing who the killer is but having not arrested them, or who the killer is but you didn't get the murder weapon.
These were variable based also, Stark? Like you didn't, when you say knowing their journey where they went to, were you explicit about that?
We could call up that, yeah, that's something I could call up. But it was something I would probably use tangentially. So then I would use it in, say, if you were talking to the murderer's neighbour, they'd be like, I last saw them, oh, I saw them leaving at midnight, because they'd gone at midnight to go to the weapon cellar to go and get a weapon and things like that. So We kind of mapped out what the journey would be, the beats we wanted to hit, and then how that would interact with the world, on a layer we could then, you know, actually make it make sense for the player, yeah. And, like, you know, are they interacting with conversations, with the CCTV system, with, you know, are they, because they'll be leaving footprints, they'll be leaving fingerprints, all of this stuff, so... I think that we're visually mapping it really helped. And then, but one of the other things we did, we can't, you know, because a player might start off on a murder investigation and get completely distracted by a side job, which that's fine. That's how they want to play it. But so I think one of the things I always try to bring it back to, there's a really good Noclip documentary about the making of Thief. And they talk about that feeling of stealth and the stealth being a really important aspect of it. And I think that's true in Shadows, because I mean, I knew it was going to be a good game right from the beginning when there was hardly anything in the world. And I was kneeling down, lockpicking a door, being like, oh, no, I'm going to get caught. And I had that feeling of like, oh, I'm going to get caught. That kind of thrilling feel to it. And that's what Shadows is at heart. It's like a stealth detective game. We wanted that you should always have that feeling that you were gumshoeing around a city, picking through trash. No one wants to talk to you. And you're kind of... Yeah, you're sleuthing out what you need from the world. And so I think keeping that feeling in mind was really important, because then if people do get sidetracked on a murder investigation, they end up doing something else. That has to feel as important and as immersive as the whole, you know, property and murder that's going on over here.
I remember when I was playing No Man's Sky, which is, you know, very much on the generation rather than distribution end of the narrative spectrum. One of the things that really stood out in that game for me was, a lot of it felt like it's a planet and every planet was just a planet and it didn't really speak to me. But the bit that really spoke to me was every time I went down into one of their caves, they had these procedurally generated cave systems, and you'd sort of wander down the cave and you'd take a left, and you'd take a right, and you'd take a left. And then I'd suddenly realize that I was lost, and I'd turn around and not know which way would take me back to the surface. And then you'd realize that absolutely nobody in the world could help me, because nobody in the world knew what shape this cave was. This cave only existed for me, and I had lost myself in it.
And you've done it. You've done it yourself. Like, you know.
Yes, exactly.
You've put yourself in that situation.
And eventually I realized I could actually, like, maybe I could drop things as a little breadcrumb trail when I was going into a cave so I could find my way back out again or something like that. And then eventually I realised you can actually just drill mine vertically upwards and escape from any cave, which is nice. Rubbish, right? And completely ruins the whole argument. But I didn't realise that at the time. But I love that idea with Shadows, that you can be in the middle of a case and have that sense that nobody can help you. Like, if somebody comes around the corner and catches you, you have been caught and no one can tell you, and you can't reload it and you can't redo it. And like, you're in that moment for one brief time, which sounds so great to me. But the drawback that I had with No Man's Sky was there was never anything interesting in any of the caves. There was just the crystals that you pick up on the planet anyway. And did you find ways to put, I guess, moments of flair or moments sort of standout moments into it, or does that just fight against the whole procgen sort of system? Is it just better to feed the system and let the system be the star, or do you try to slip kind of, I don't know, zingers or just brilliant ideas or one like?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm a writer, I'm going to try and get them in everywhere, aren't I? That's part of the struggle. It's part of the struggle, because sometimes having it is less is more, because the minute you kind of hint that this could be something more than a kind of quite basic system, people want it to be a lot more than basic system. So it was a bit of a balancing act between keeping things pared back so that they worked and we weren't going to create loads of bugs, and then kind of, yeah, jamming in as many zingers as we could. And I think one of the ways we did that was relying quite heavily on the static text, and things like audio events, which aren't necessarily linked to the murder, but and I mean, like, we were so stupidly extra with so much of this. Like, we at one point we wanted to have sports games playing on the TV, because we always wanted that feeling where you hear someone's TV through the wall and you know they're in and they're up and listening to all of that. We decided to have a sports game, but we couldn't have a normal sports game because it's us. So I created a fake sports game called Bass Boule, which is a cross between baseball and petanque. And and then we actually proc-genned the whole sports matches.
The whole game. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you hear it on TV, you're hearing a proc-gen. It won't be the same match every time. It's a proc-gen audio event. Anyway, it's completely irrelevant to the murders. But there's a lot of world building in there. There's a lot of kind of immersive detail about the world in general. And I think So maybe we kind of were able to make up for some of the texture that we don't get in the kind of in the system, the way the system is delivered, with all of our mad, immersive, extra kind of world building stuff.
It does sound like a lot of the joy in working with a ProcGen system is just to really lean into that ProcGen system enormously and say, okay, fine, we're going to do this, but we're going to do it so much more than anyone expects us to do it, that the delight, instead of the delight being in like a carefully balanced character moment or a very wittily turned twist as you might have in a linear novel, should anyone write linear novels again, instead it's the delight is, oh my god, there's a gambling system based on the sports team, based on the player, based on the, you know, the kind of the chains of
the cascade.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. And those moments of the storytelling, which are really funny, you know, you can't, NPCs doing stuff you would never expect. So one of them, you know, one guy just been handcuffed and was kneeling on the floor with his, you know, his hands behind his back, and another guy just walks up to him and goes, "Keep him well." So of course, they know each other, so of course they would say that. They are unintentionally so funny. Some of the things that you encounter.
And I think all of this works because the player knows when they go into a game like this. They know what they've signed up for, right? They know that they're not playing a Santa Monica Studios game, right? Like, they know that they're playing a game where there are going to be surprising moments that are not going to be scripted. You're not going to know what's happening. And there's a thrill in that. There's a thrill in being like, this is the story just for me. It's the thrill that we so often want to give to our players when we're like, it's the true fantasy is of player agency, right? Of like, this is my mystery, and the game will allow me to sort of, within constraints, to do it the way that I want to. I think that is the unusual thing, right? Surely, like, that the player isn't trying to fight you on it. They're trying to sort of engage with the developers on this title.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as long as people, when people start to role play it as well, that's when that works really well, because we are trying to give them as much agency as possible within this world to solve cases or not. You know, you can just sit in a cafe and throw croque monsieurs at people if you want. Like, that's a perfectly legitimate thing to do in the game. So I think as long as people, when people start sort of role-playing it, that's when they get the most out of it.
Yeah, I love this. Like, I often talk about The Last Express, which is my favourite game of all time, and there's a violin scene in it where you can go and listen to a violin concerto that's being performed by one of the characters, and it's completely unhelpful as a thing to do from a gameplay point of view. You absolutely should not do that, but you can do. Just sit there and enjoy the ambience of that moment. And yeah, I think there's something really delightful about creating worlds with enough space in them that the player can do things without having to be goal focused and get something out of that. That feels like still quite a special thing in games when we manage that. So I think that's lovely. That's really lovely. So, Stark, your future projects that you're working on at the moment, are they still procedurally generated craziness, or are we more technical experiments, or are you just more linear dialogue trees now?
Well, I mean, I can only talk about my project. I'm of, you know, the classic NDA on anything I'm working on currently. But from my perspective, I mean, I've just finished a historical novel which is on submission at the moment, so hopefully that will be coming out at some point soon. Thank you. And I have, like, you know, it's not immune to my poking at the form either, because it is full of bits of epigrams and then people making comments in the footnotes. So I'm hoping there's some tolerance for footnotes out there.
Because I couldn't
leave it alone. I couldn't leave the form alone. So but now, actually, after talking to you and after doing this, I'm full of enthusiasm for trying to do some interactive kind of choose your own adventure science fiction stuff again. So Maybe I'll find some time to do that too.
We wish you all the best with it. It's been absolutely delightful talking to you. There's so much creativity and so much, like, delight in the form and the possibilities of the form, and I just think that's glorious to hear. So let's wrap it up there. Thank you very much again, Stark Holborn, for joining us. That's absolutely brilliant. And listeners, please join us next week as we open the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope to another page and talk to another delightful game writer. So thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.